the Federal News Countdown in just a moment. Want to mention to you that this is the first Federal News Countdown at 3 o'clock up until now. We started these in January of 2010. So for the last year and couple months, we've been doing them at 2 o'clock. We've moved it to 3 because In Depth now on the air between 3 and 7 every afternoon. So, the guest that I have on the program today, Tim Hakes from AgileX, the Chief Technology Officer there. Thank you for being here, by the way, Tim. It's great to see you.
Thanks for having me.
And Larry Allen, President of Allen Federal, and you guys are groundbreakers. You're the first 3 o'clock countdown guests. It's a pretty cool deal.
We're revered to be here at this special time.
Yeah, you're just full of reverence, I can tell.
Right.
I'm glad to have you both here today. There is a poll that I want you to go to at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. Normally our polls are involved with really cutting edge issues that are of great importance to the people who work for the federal government. Since it's Friday, we're trying a little lighter poll out today, and it's simply about my bow tie. I'm wearing a bow tie today for the first time outside of a formal event. Our national security correspondent, J.J. Green, wears them all the time, and I've mentioned from time to time how cool I think they look, and he said, well, you should try one. And I went, oh, I don't know. So today I did, and our internet editor, Jolie Lee, took a picture and posted it at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. And is inviting people to vote whether they like it or don't like the bow tie. And I checked right before I came on the air, and there was only one vote against the bow tie, and I found out that it was from my wife. So I'm not sure what that means, really. But so check that out, and we will find out later on what people think of the bow tie, because I'm just not sure whether it's something I should continue or not. What do you guys think? Any thoughts?
Well, when I first came in and I saw you wearing it, it was the first time we'd met and face-to-face.
Yes.
And I thought you carried it quite well.
Oh, thank you. They're very nice. Because not everybody can pull it off. I know that.
You're a very patriotic guy, Francis. People can tell it's a red, white, and blue bow tie, making you obviously a cap supporter for the playoffs.
That's true.
And a follower sartorial fashion.
Well, that might be overselling it just a little bit, Larry. But, yes, I did not intend to display my cap support with the bow tie. Just kind of worked out that way.
It's well tied as well.
Well, I tied it myself.
Yeah.
Thank you. And thank you for noticing, because not everybody gets that.
How long did it take you?
Took me about 5 minutes. I followed a video on YouTube, to be quite honest with you. A great Federal News Countdown we have lined up today. You guys have chosen great stories, and we'll start, of course, with
number three.
The third most important federal news story of the week, according to Tim Hakes, is headline, DARPA works to build electronic neural architectures that can learn, adapt, and respond. Now, I have to confess, normally when I see a news story that's got DARPA in it, I can make it through the first paragraph or two, and then it starts to be well over my head. What's going on here, Tim?
Well, I'm not sure that this is the third most profound story of the week, but I did find it interesting, and so that's why I included it. We're seeing so much now in government, this need to get our hands around huge amounts of data.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that we're doing more and more of the same with bigger and bigger, faster computers. And so these kinds of initiatives where the government is investing in trying to find innovative technological ways to approach problems from a whole new perspective,
mm-hmm.
not just more of the same, I find quite compelling. And it's also important to me because I like to see the government continuing to invest in real research. It's
mm-hmm.
not just let's see if we can buy a bigger computer or buy a few more people to try and figure out the problem in the same old way. So I'm compelled by the fact that they are doing this kind of research, and especially as it relates to some of the hard information problems that we're going to have to figure out new ways to solve.
I've been surprised in this Congress at the focus on R&D spending, not just in DOD or DHS, where you would think a lot of that focus would be, but all across agencies. Congress wants to know. It seems like they're asking a lot of questions about R&D and the plans that the agencies have, instead of just saying, this would be a great place to cut, because it's not going to show any results within 20 minutes.
It's great, because typically, it's one of the first things to get cut, and it's as we see so much of the cost cutting going on in IT, especially over the last 2 weeks, where mm-hmm. it's been at the tip of everybody's conversation. The amount of money we spend on doing things rather than innovating new things is out of balance to me. And the government has always been, certainly through the 50s and 60s and early 70s, was the place where basic research was done. And we've lost that over the last, 10, 15, 20 years. And so to see that having a focus inside the legislators where they think about where they put the money is encouraging to me.
This may be one of the most twisted around acronyms that I've ever seen in government, too. This sounds really cool. The goal of Synapse is what this is called,
right,
is to create electronic systems inspired by the human brain that can understand, adapt, and respond to information in fundamentally different ways than traditional computers. But this is how they got Synapse. It stands, Synapse stands for Systems of Neuromorphic Adaptive Plastic Scalable Electronics. That is fantastic.
That's right. Named by engineers. Mm-hmm. And so what's great is it clearly describes what the technology is attempting to do.
Exactly.
And they managed to organize the words in such a way that they can make a brain term out of it.
You can insert your pocket protector joke here.
Exactly.
Tim Hake's number three story of the week is headlined, DARPA works to build electronic neural architectures that can learn, adapt, and respond. It's from NanoWork News, and you can find it linked up at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. Larry Allen, your number three story is from our friend Steve Kelman about the purchase card program. He has some thoughts to improve it in his lectern blog at FCW. He's actually going to talk about this with me on the show on Monday. But what struck you about some of Steve's thoughts about the purchase card program?
Well, Francis, there were two things in this article that I thought were interesting. One is there's the facet here that tells a good news story, and good news stories in government procurement and contracting are so rare to come by that it's worth noting that this was a good news story. And what's good about it is that Dr. Kelman highlights the fact that GSA, through its purchase card program, has started to put in more and more systems where government buyer can go to a retail outlet and get the GSA schedule price if that retail shop is part of a company that has a schedule. For example, Home Depot. If you go in and use your government purchase card at the Home Depot register, you automatically get the GSA schedule discount for that item because Home Depot is a GSA schedule contract holder.
Mm-hmm.
GSA is doing more and more of those things. So whether or not you even know there's a schedules program or whether or not you are trying to get a discount, if you're using your purchase card at that retail outlet, you get that discount and the government saves money. That's the good side of this. The other side that I saw is one that you hear frequently, Francis, about government contractors or from government contractors, rather, when government agencies use the purchase card for large purchases. There's a transaction fee, an interchange fee,
mm-hmm,
that is tagged on each one of these purchase card transactions. And in the commercial market, you know, you or I can go down to the store and maybe we'll go on and buy plane tickets online, or so it's several hundred dollars. But in the government market, you'll have government customers who will make purchases of $100,000 or $200,000,
right,
with the purchase card. And to the credit card company, that can be 3%. 3% of $300 when you're buying a round-trip plane ticket isn't that much. But if you're buying, let's say, $120,000 worth of furniture, that 3% really eats into your bottom line if you're the contractor, on top of the discount that you have to give to GSA and the industrial funding fee that you have to remit back. And a number of companies are very reluctant to accept purchase card as a method of payment at those higher dollar levels precisely because of the exchange fee that they have to pay. And one of the things that I worked with when I was at the Coalition for Government Procurement was, are there ways to reduce purchase card fees so that the transactions don't cut into the bottom line? And that's the second part of what Steve Kelman's talking about here, is let's find a way to do that. I agree with him, as I usually do. And it's a good way to do it because the purchase card program in government overall has been tremendously successful as a way not just to expedite payment but to reduce government overhead.
I mentioned that Steve will be on with us next week on the program to talk about this and get into more detail about some of these thoughts. But we've got the story posted for you at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. It's Larry Allen's third most important federal news story of the week on the Federal News Countdown on In-Depth on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Larry is here with Tim Hakes from AgileX, and we'll get up to story number two for both Tim and for Larry Allen when In-Depth continues on Federal News Radio 1500 AM.
Government personnel must continue to achieve mission-critical objectives no matter their work environment. Video conferencing technologies provide a highly effective collaboration solution for federal employees affected by budget cuts, BRAC initiatives, and telework mandates if they are secure based on open standards and deployable in limited bandwidth environments. Polycom is the first video provider to have an ultimate HD portfolio that is JITC certified, offering real-time face-to-face communication without compromising secure networks or consuming excessive bandwidth. Polycom enables government customers to collaborate over voice and video anywhere, anytime, securely both inside and outside the firewall, offering high-definition video calls at half the bandwidth of other companies. To learn more, visit polycom.com/federal.
The Telework Center arms you with all the information you need to know about teleworking in the federal government. Go to federalnewsradio.com, keyword Polycom.
The website of the week is the Google Transparency Report. Now, this site includes an interactive map, so you can click on different countries. The Chinese officials consider censorship demands to be state secrets, so we cannot disclose that information at this time. This can show traffic patterns. If a country blocks internet access, you can immediately see this. You can see if any countries are blocking internet traffic. The Google Transparency Report.
Stratford University's Tech Talk Radio, Saturday mornings from 9 to 10 on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
The American Legion. We're a powerful force for the nation. We pledge ourselves to our veterans, our youth, a strong national defense, and Americanism. These four pillars shape our work and what we do for America. We work relentlessly within our four pillars of service, and we succeed. Go to legion.org to find out more about the American Legion's commitment of service to America.
Today's ISR report is brought to you by FLIR Systems.
If a major business or government agency is hit by a cyber attack and their own IT team is overwhelmed, who is going to come and help them? That question is worrisome to the U.S. lawmakers and members of the Obama administration. It looks as though a military response may be the answer. General Keith Alexander, head of the National Security Agency and the U.S. Cyber Command, told Congress coordinated cyber attacks could shut down the U.S. power grid, stock exchanges, and the Internet. I'm J.J. Green.
For more than 30 years, FLIR Systems has provided customers with trusted support needed in critical missions. With a full spectrum of products designed to enhance perception and awareness, FLIR's threat detection systems are used by civilian and government agencies around the world. FLIR now provides comprehensive radiation detection and identification for threat detection, disaster preparedness, and emergency management, such as the ongoing crisis in Japan. For more information, visit FLIR.com/detection.
I'm Amy Morris. Here's a look at Friday morning's Federal Drive. NASA wants to develop the next generation of green airplanes. We'll learn about this latest public-private partnership. Is your customer service lacking in the eyes of American citizens? We'll find out how you can energize your e-initiatives from Right Now Technologies. That and more Friday morning starting at 6 on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. And for all the latest federal news, check out our website, federalnewsradio.com.
Back on In-Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Tim Hakes of AgileX and Larry Allen of Allen Federal, my guests on the Federal News Countdown this week, and we're up to
number two.
second most important federal news story of the week, according to Tim Hakest, is from the Wall Street Journal. And the headline is Mobile App Talent Pool is Shallow. Now, we've talked a lot on this show about how the cybersecurity talent pool is not as deep as we would like it to be. But this idea, this concept is interesting because so many agencies are trying to develop apps. They're trying to figure out the best ways possible to communicate with the most amount of citizens, customers, clients, whatever you want to call them. And the way that that seems to be, one of the ways that that seems to be, is to be able to create apps, ways of moving information directly to people in the way that they want to consume that information. This does not make that challenge sound very easy to meet over the coming 5 to 10 years, does it, Tim?
Yeah, no, it doesn't. The tidal wave of enthusiasm for building mobile applications in government has been building over the last 12 to 18 months in a way that has been both exciting but a bit daunting when we think about who's going to be able to deliver. And there are really two kinds of apps, some that you describe where maybe more commercially available apps that citizens or consumers will download and interact with government services. But then there are also these enterprise apps inside government organizations where they're sending out field inspectors or putting applications in the hands of warfighters or all sorts of apps that are going to be distributed in the thousands or tens of thousands of units very quickly. And these have to be highly secure and highly robust and have all of the integrity and of implementation that we expect from an enterprise information system, a government information system. And so finding people that can build those kinds of systems is going to be a great challenge, and partly because the market for that is growing so quickly.
Yeah. Is part of the problem maybe the fact that what people traditionally think of now, or what people traditionally thought of as apps, are not what people think of as apps now? When I think if you went to 10 people, even people who are government IT type people, and you said, what's an app? What's your definition of an app? Probably half of them would answer, that's something I get on my smartphone, not necessarily a piece of software that we use to accomplish a specific task.
Yeah,
do you think that's fair?
That's absolutely fair. So a lot of times we get asked about building apps, and people are thinking of, like you said, a tip calculator that runs on my phone.
Yeah, right? Exactly.
And that's cool and all, but that's only the tip of the iceberg. We look at mobile devices as front ends to your information systems.
Yes. Right?
So you still got to build the infrastructure, and it's got to be highly scalable because you're going to have thousands of these devices out there. It's got to have a way of narrowing the data so that it fits on the screen, so that it's small to get over these narrow PUT networks and so on. So how do we write whole information systems that are mobily enabled, not just mobile apps? Writing tip calculators is frankly not that hard.
Right.
That's why there are hundreds of thousands of them out there written by kids, you know, teenagers, literally.
Yeah.
Writing enterprise information systems that are secure and scalable that exploit the wide variety of mobile devices is another challenge altogether.
Yeah.
And so we're going to see a marrying of the kinds of expertise that we're accustomed to seeing building these kinds of systems with new expertise around optimizing that for mobile devices. There's another dimension which gets added, which is the user experience people when it's mobile. When you have a big computer screen, you have the luxury to be crude, I guess, in your design and implementation. I've seen a lot of systems that get the job done but are not a pleasant user experience. On these mobile devices, the user experience has got to be so tight and fit in the space and be intuitive and so on that the need for creative people that know how to do that, but that also understand what business problem is being solved and what the information is intended to represent, that requires some new kinds of thinking, and those people are rare indeed. And so for these systems to be compelling, we're going to really have to start either training or tapping into new sources for these kinds of people.
Larry, I wonder if that misconception about what an app really is might also be driving some of this recruiting problem, this talent pool problem, because if that's, if my model of maybe half of IT pros in government thinking of an app as one thing and the other half thinking of the other thing, I bet if you went down to a high school student or a college student and you said, we want to recruit you to come make apps, they're going to go, you want me to make little 99-cent deals that are going to be in the iTunes store? There's no future in that.
I think you're exactly right, Francis. I think that Tim's point is a very, very good one. I know when I saw the headline for the article, I'm like, apps in government.
Yeah.
Aside from the tip calculator, was it the FAR easy reference? Something like that. But
searchable FAR.
That's right. That's right.
Sell that for 99 cents a pop.
I'm sure people would be breaking down your door.
Oh, yeah.
But I think Tim's point is an excellent one, that this is something that is a challenge, particularly if you're going to have a mobile workforce in the government, something that I know you've talked about frequently on your show and talk a lot about on the station generally. And if people, I think, understood that in technology a little bit better, you know, the government now, at least parts of it, is becoming an employer of choice among some college students. You have DHS and the CIA among two that regularly show up in the top 10 of where college graduates want to land. I suspect we'd have a little bit more of that if people had a full understanding of the technology capability, and people are going to pay you more than 99 cents per whack to develop these apps.
Yeah, yeah. Tim Hake's story number two on the countdown this week is Mobile App Talent Pool is Shallow. It's from the Wall Street Journal, and you can find it linked up at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. Story number two from Larry Allen's next up when we continue the Federal News Countdown on Federal News Radio 1500 AM.
This is NIH Health Matters. I'm Joe Belinfi. A new genetic disease has been identified. It's rare, debilitating, and is the result of an error in one gene.
So the gene is defective, and the gene product was not being made, or it was being made improperly. Therefore, it wasn't functioning appropriately.
Dr. William Gall is with the National Human Genome Research Institute. He says that gene product is a protein called CD73.
So if you have a defect in that gene, you're not producing the CD73 protein, and therefore there's calcification that occurs.
Painful calcification occurs in blood vessels below the waist and in joints of the hands and feet. For details, visit www.genome.gov. Health Matters is produced by the National Institutes of Health, part of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services.
What does sustainability truly mean? How can agencies overcome the cultural, policy, and organizational resistance to change? In the midst of challenging economic circumstances, looming budget constraints, and compliance requirements with recent executive orders and policy directives, U.S. government agencies are under increased pressure to employ sustainability practices. Understanding the importance of sustainable efficiency in operations and the impact that the use of natural resources has on both our environment and our well-being as a society is paramount. Listen to Beyond Green, Making Sustainability Sustainable, as part of the Booz Allen Hamilton Expert Voices panel series, featuring sustainability experts from across government. Thursday, April 21st at 11 a.m. on Federal News Radio 1500 a.m. For more information, go to federalnewsradio.com, keyword Booz Allen, or visit the Expert Voices blog at boozallen.com/expertvoices.
Things just don't happen. You need a plan. A federal career can last 30 years or more, and so can federal retirement. Tune in each Monday at 10 a.m. to get the information you need to plan your course for financial security, solid benefits, and optimum health care. 100% focused on the federal employee for your benefit, presented by NITP, has the answers to your mid-career and retirement planning questions. Listen to For Your Benefit, Mondays at 10 a.m. on 1500 a.m. Federal News Radio for an hour that can change your future.
Frustrated by how quickly the battery drains in your electronic devices? A new engineering innovation may one day dramatically extend the time you can stay unplugged. In electronic devices, a lot of power is drained by shuttling information to silicon memory chips. So Eric Popp, a University of Illinois engineering professor, has used carbon nanotubes 10,000 times smaller than a human hair to activate memory storage material at extremely low voltages.
We've been able to make this about 100 times more energy efficient and about 100 times faster than anything in industry today.
Popp thinks they could make it even better, but manufacturing hurdles remain.
Nobody has figured out a way to integrate them at the scale of a billion nanotubes per chip, the way we do with silicon today.
But Popp believes that's only a matter of time. To find out more about this and other engineering innovation stories, please go to www.nae.edu/radio. That's nae.edu/radio. With the National Academy of Engineering, Randy Atkins, Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
As gas prices rise, focus is shifting toward the administration's ambitious clean energy goals. Join AFSEA Bethesda and AFSEA Energy May 4th at the Bethesda North Marriott for the second Energy and the Environment IT Day, featuring EPA, DOE, GSA, NRC, the DOD, NOAA, and Interior. View the impressive speaker lineup and register at AFSEABethesda.com/EEITday. Special thanks to premier sponsors Booz Allen, CGI Federal, DLT Solutions, General Dynamics, Lockheed Martin, Northrop Grumman, and platinum sponsors HP and Centurion Research Solutions.
We're back on In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. It's the Federal News Countdown with Tim Hagstrom, Agilex, and Larry Allen of Allen Federal. And normally in the breaks on the shows, we talk about very cutting-edge, incisive issues, and today we're discussing my bow tie. The poll that's up at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth, do you like Francis Rose with the bow tie? Because today's the first day I've worn one to work. Right now is running 56% yes and 44% no. So in a political election, that would be a landslide. But it's a lot closer when it comes to this whole bow tie issue.
What key states are those votes from?
that's really it. We've got to slice the data down and figure out the demographics on the bow tie. Larry Allen, your story number two on the countdown this week is from GovExec. It's headlined, Former White House and Congressional Leaders Call for Faster Appointment Process. And this is something that I've talked about a number of times. In fact, most recently with Clay Johnson, who's part of this commission hosted by the Aspen Institute the Rockefeller Foundation to try to advance legislation, which it appears they've succeeded in doing, to cut the number of political appointees that have to be confirmed by the Senate. Bill Frist and Chuck Robb, former senators, former White House Chief of Staff, Mac McClarty, who was President Clinton's Chief of Staff, and Clay Johnson was, of course, Deputy Director for Management at OMB, were at the head of this organization. And they put an op-ed in the Washington Post this week talking about this issue. The bill came out of the Homeland Security Committee yesterday or the day before. I can't remember which now. But this is 200 non-policymaking, non-senior positions would no longer require Senate confirmation. Do you give this a thumbs up or a thumbs down?
I definitely give it a thumbs up, Francis, for as far as it goes. Right now, I think that last count we had 11 or 1200 positions that required Senate consent. That's a significant growth even over the last 10 years. It used to be 400 was considered a lot. Now mm-hmm. it's over 1,100. And if the Senate did nothing else, it would be spending its time providing advice and consent for political appointees. And while we want them to have a legitimate oversight role, that's the Constitution after all, the fact is that not everybody needs to have a formal hearing and a formal up and down vote to take a political appointeeship. And what this is that whether it really doesn't matter if you're a Republican or a Democrat, if you're a believer in good government management, this is an issue that you want to care about. And I think that that's indicated by the fact that the legislation was put forward by a very bipartisan group of people,
mm-hmm.
People who are you know, well-regarded now on the national scene. And what happens, Francis, is you get agencies who, at the beginning of an administration, even sometimes in the middle of the administration, they don't have their political leadership.
Mm-hmm.
Well, things automatically shift down maybe into third gear. Government management doesn't stop. Government agencies don't stop doing their things. But they're not taking on new projects. They're not going to put any significant big picture items into play because they know at some point they're going to be getting a new political appointee who's going to be the leader, and they want to make sure that that leader has the chance to weigh in on the things that the agency is going to be doing, and maybe the leader has a different idea.
Mm-hmm.
So what happens is now you can go months, sometimes a year or more, without having a political appointee because the hearing hasn't gotten around to taking place, or maybe there's an extended hold on that. As we know, one of those in this administration was Martha Johnson.
Yep.
The General Services Administration, GSA, without a leader for close to 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that certainly hampered the ability of the agency to take on significant new projects. You extrapolate that across government, and you have a government that ultimately works less efficiently.
Mm-hmm. Tim, from your perspective as a company that does business with the government and with agencies, where these people who are to be the leaders of projects or policy initiatives or whatever, but they're not there, what's the perspective from your point of view?
Action takes leadership.
Yeah.
And so many government leaders are already hindered by the fact that they often have a short tenure to begin with, even in ideal situations, whether it's a term or a change in administration or in DOD cycling through different assignments, they already have this short window. And so when there's a delay in getting them in place, the opportunity they have to incite change and to and progress and offer their leadership to force action is so small that they often are forced to just pick one or two things.
Right.
Say, okay, I'll focus on this one thing rather than all that they could offer. And so we find it greatly frustrating whenever we're trying to help an organization along and they don't yet have that kind of guidance from the top because of these vacuums in these positions.
We have a link for not only the story that Larry Allen's chosen as the number two story of the week on the Federal News Countdown, which is a GovExec story headline, former White House and congressional leaders call for faster appointment process. But we also have a link up to the Washington Post op-ed, and we dug into that when it came out on In-Depth, and you can find that at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. The number one story of the week from Larry Allen and from Tim Hakes will be up in just moments when the Federal News Countdown continues on In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio 1500 AM.
Like you, I watch the cherry blossoms bloom in the spring. I live amongst monuments and museums. I enjoy walks on the National Mall. Washington, D.C. is my home. This is where I found my career. I am a civilian employee of the United States Coast Guard. That's right, the Coast Guard. The Coast Guard provides me with great workplace training and excellent federal benefits. It allows me to live my life to the fullest. I have time off to travel and have flexible work hours so I can spend time with my family. Coast Guard gives me access to childcare, health and fitness programs, and first-class health insurance, life insurance, and retirement benefits. This is my career. It's how I serve. Find out more about U.S. Coast Guard positions available in D.C. and across the U.S. at CoastGuardCivilian.com/federal. That's CoastGuardCivilian.com/federal. The U.S. Coast Guard is an equal opportunity employer.
The Susan G. Komen Global Race for the Cure is coming to D.C. Saturday, June 4th, and together we can make an impact. Whether it's just you and a friend or your whole neighborhood, start or join a team today. $28 million has already been raised and invested in local breast cancer programs in our community alone. But there's more to be done. Be a part of the global community, united against breast cancer. Register today at globalraceforthecure.org or visit WTOP.com, search Cure.
This is Mark Amtower. I've been advising contractors for almost 30 years, and when they need agency contacts, I always recommend Carroll's GovSearch. With over 350,000 contact listings and over 1,000 government organization charts, they help you find the people you need to reach in all levels of government. Give them a try. Get a free organization chart and a sample listing from their database. Contact Gordon Peel at 703-757-8228. Carroll Publishing, bringing government to you like no other.
Thanks for listening to In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. It's the Federal News Countdown, where two people who are experts in the world of the federal government choose the news stories they think are the three most important to people who work for the government, rank them in order from number three to number one, and count them down every Friday at 3 on the Federal News Countdown. My guests today are Tim Hakes from AgileX and Larry Allen, the president of Allen Federal, and we're up to
number one.
The most important federal news story of the week, according to Tim, is from Information Week, and the headline is Federal IT Reform Finds Success in the Cloud. And we're finally at a point, I think, with cloud computing, Tim, where people have narrowed the choices. It seemed for a while there were about 80 different choices of how you could do the cloud. It seems now to be pretty much three or four main tracks that both agencies are willing to consider and that vendors want to sell. And also it seems like we're finally getting a handle around what's appropriate to go into the cloud and what's not. Is that a fair representation, do you think?
I think it is. Clearly in the last couple of weeks, there's been a lot of focus on costs and of IT and, and how some of the CIO's office's initiatives around IT consolidation and cloud computing are impacting the expense imposed on government by information technology. And the cloud is one of the first ones that I think is starting to bear fruit early, where you can actually point at savings, which is great. Ironically, I think if you'd asked me a year ago whether that were going to be true, I'd have said, no way.
And how come?
Not because I don't believe in it as an approach for spending the government's money more wisely, but because I didn't expect them to be able to make as much progress as they've made this quickly. I think it's been in part because they've been, pushed to do it, which is great, but also been able to pick some of the low-hanging fruit, email systems and file stores, not mission-oriented systems as much as business-oriented systems. And the commercial providers have been giving them more robust places to do that. And so a lot of it is about getting past the fear of understanding that A, I can have good service even if it's outside my control. B, I can have secure service even though it's outside the government's network boundaries. Once people break through those barriers and understand this is possible, then I think it opens a dam of opportunity for them to bring other systems to this model. So I'm happy to see the early success.
Larry, the government certainly has made it easy for agencies to get it, too, by putting up apps.gov.
Apps.gov, and it also doesn't hurt at all, Francis, that Vivek Kundra, the federal CIO, has been the leading advocate, providing a lot of top cover for people, and letting people know that it's okay, but not just that it's okay, but to the point where several agencies have adopted a cloud-first policy for buying these types of services. And when you get that type of top-level buy-in, then federal people everywhere follow suit, and they know that it's a comfortable thing to do, that they're not going to get criticized for as long as they follow the rules.
I have a kind of a nerd question for
you,
Tim.
I love this.
Does Moore's Law apply to cloud computing?
Well, I think the more... I wouldn't say it necessarily in those terms.
Okay.
But I do think that the cost savings will scale.
Okay.
And I do think the performance and levels of service will scale appreciably. Whether that scales like Moore's Law or not is
so maybe it's unclear. Maybe it's the concept behind Moore's Law will apply to the cloud, not necessarily the actual equation.
Right, of course. But the idea that the more of this we do, the more of this we'll be able to do.
Yes.
The more benefit we'll get from it, I think is absolutely true. In many ways, the capacity of the cloud to offer service is far greater than the current capacity of service we're offering ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
And so once we move out of this and move into that,
yep,
we'll scale nicely. Mm-hmm. The other thing it does is, we talked earlier about the DARPA thing.
Mm-hmm.
It frees our government technology resources to focus on solving mission-oriented problems through those kinds of innovations, not just on running the old systems.
Mm-hmm.
And so the scalability is not just, as you described, more at lower cost,
yeah,
but better with what we're doing inside.
So it changes the equation even well beyond the question that I was getting at. That to me is kind of a linear thing. Moore's law is linear, where you're talking about something that's almost 3D compared to
It's not in the government. It's not necessarily just about spending less, but it's about spending our dollars more wisely toward the mission. And clearly today it's also about spending less, right? So we're definitely looking for ways in which we can spend less. But the first place we have to stop that spending is on easy, repetitive stuff that somebody else can do cheaper.
Yeah.
And so that's what the cloud's about. A lot of these commercial offerings are about that.
Mm-hmm.
So then we can spend our precious resources on doing things that are unique to our mission challenges.
Uh-huh.
And that, you're right, changes the equation.
Yeah. The concept of this, I think, is it's hard for some people still to wrap their heads around. And it strikes me that if we get past that, then the gains that we're going to see in whether it's cost savings or productivity or however you want to measure it are really going to be hard to contain, I think.
That's true. The people are learning to wrap their heads around it,
mm-hmm,
as I said, by taking the early steps. A classic example of this is email.
Mm-hmm.
You think of email as a information system, but you know what? Email is not hard.
Yeah.
And so having an email system run by somebody else who run bigger email systems than anybody else in the world is a great place to do it.
Yeah.
The government organizations are not yet there in more of their core mission systems,
mm-hmm,
whether those are intelligence systems or accounting systems in the financial part of government or health systems in the medical part of government and so on. Those systems are going to take longer to get to cloud services. They might get to cloud infrastructure,
mm-hmm,
where you're going to companies that just provide physical infrastructure, but the systems are still run and managed by government personnel rather, mm-hmm, than totally outsourced like email can be.
Yeah.
And so each of those will find their sweet spot. But my fear was that it was going to take a lot longer than it has for the initial holes in the dam to start to appear. And
mm-hmm,
so that has happened, I think, as the testimony referenced in this article starts to express.
Tim Hake's number one story of the week on the Federal News Countdown is from Information Week. The headline is Federal IT Reform Finds Success in the Cloud. And you can read it and all of the stories that we're counting down today on the Federal News Countdown at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. Larry Allen's number one story of the week up next as we wrap up today's Federal News Countdown. It's In Depth with Francis Rose.
IT professionals and graduates from around the country have a lot to say about their experiences from the online Masters in Information Systems from UMBC, the University of Maryland, Baltimore County.
My current title is Chief of Technology. That was one of the things that I was actually looking for, was to have chief or officer within my position title.
Apply today for our upcoming semester. For more information, call 1-800-353-UMBC or visit us online at onlinems.umbc.edu.
In the beloved fairy tale Beauty and the Beast, Belle and the Beast learn that true beauty is found within and live happily ever after. Today, our happily ever afters are being threatened by the fact that nearly 1 in 3 children in America are overweight or obese. Now is the time to make good nutrition and physical activity part of your family's daily lifestyle. To learn more, visit letsmove.gov, brought to you by Let's Move, the U.S. Department of Agriculture, and the Ad Council.
Today's Insight Report is provided by Deloitte.
Changes in the way that government agencies conduct their operations today increases the vulnerability to insider exploitation. Minimizing the risk of insider threats calls for a more comprehensive approach that includes workforce, cybersecurity, infrastructure, and physical security, as well as information management. Download Deloitte's perspective at Deloitte.com/US/insider threat. Deloitte.com/US/insider threat.
Today, you're tasked with protecting America's networks from cyber attack, training the next generation of cyber top guns, keeping sensitive data safe and secure, and getting to your daughter's soccer game by 6. If you're in government, your cyber to-do list is challenging. Turn to Deloitte. We have the people, insight, and experience to help you address pressing cyber issues and help government help America. Insights and opportunities at Deloitte.com/federal.
I wasn't born to go with the flow. I was born to make a difference, to make waves. I want my sweat and hard work to mean something. I was born to serve in the United States Coast Guard. If you were born ready to lead, to protect, to uphold the law, then visit GoCoastGuard.com. The United States Coast Guard. Born ready.
Sponsored by the United States Coast Guard. In cooperation with the Maryland, D.C., Delaware Broadcasters Association and this station.
Cybersecurity runs deeper than information assurance. It includes mobile security, cyber innovations, forensics, collaboration. That's why last month the Defense Department increased its cyber budget request by nearly $1 billion. And it's why DHS is taking unprecedented steps to assume responsibility government-wide. Join FCA Bethesda on April 29th at the Bethesda North Marriott for its executive breakfast on the latest developments in mission-critical cybersecurity. For speaker lineup and to register, visit FCABethesda.com.
Thanks for listening to In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. It's the Federal News Countdown this week with Larry Allen of Allen Federal and Tim Hakest of Agilex. And Larry, your number one story this week's from the Wall Street Journal. The headline is Spending Cut Hokum. And it turns out that the $38 billion that we thought were being cut out of the continuing resolution for the rest of the fiscal year was a lot smaller than we thought we were getting. $38 billion, it turns out, is not actually $38 billion, it looks like.
No, it's not, Francis. As a matter of fact, there was a follow-on article this morning in GovExec that further codified it. It's a little under $350 million with an M, not $38.5 billion with a B. That's being cut in real terms. And I mention this for a couple of reasons, not all of which are the immediate obvious, you know, Congress playing smoke and mirrors with the budget again. But to also say, you know, we've talked a lot here, and you and I have spoken before, about government contractors looking at a very tight government marketplace, and you start talking about big figures like $38.5 billion, and people start thinking, you know, am I going to be able to make my numbers this year for my business? And the reality is that, hey, look, you know, government market may not be growing by leaps and bounds, but it's not really shrinking either. In fact, part and parcel of the continuing resolution that was voted on yesterday included a $5 billion increase for the Department of Defense.
Mm-hmm.
Now, not all of that's going to make its way down to the contracting community, but it's hardly a time to start wringing your hands excessively about tight government budgets. You have to be smart about it if you're doing business in this marketplace, but it doesn't mean that we're having Armageddon either.
Tim, either at the level of the cuts or maybe at a broader level, what'd you take away from this whole continuing resolution deal? Separate out the effect that it had on the agencies, just as somebody watching this with the interest in government that you have. What about it struck you one way or the other?
The biggest challenge is the hesitation it creates toward action. And
mm-hmm.
we spend a lot of time in the national security community, and they have real problems that need to be addressed continuously and aggressively. And when fear of what's going to happen tomorrow with budgets goes on and on, and people hesitate to act mm-hmm. in ways that they know need to be take action, it not only, frankly, stresses us out because we are not sure what's going to happen tomorrow,
uh-huh.
but it stresses the system out, and it's frustrating to see things that should be happening not happening or just being put off indefinitely until something comes down from the hill. And that was scary for a little while.
I saw very few positives come out of this whole shutdown conversation, but one positive that I saw was that people on both sides of the aisle seemed to understand that, especially when it came down to when the numbers got really, really close, people on both sides of the aisle seemed to understand it would cost more to shut the government down and then have to do all the startup stuff than would be saved by whatever cuts they were able to accomplish. And that message got around well, which I was happily surprised to see.
Well, that's right. Just because you shut the government down doesn't mean you're not incurring costs.
Right.
In fact, you incur some very significant costs, both to shut things down and then to ramp them back up again. Arguably more than $38.5 billion and certainly more than $330 million. Mm-hmm. I think the other side of this story, Francis, also is that, you know, if we're looking forward for the fiscal health of the country, I think we're looking at really budget cuts that are going to need to be a little bit more real in terms of what they actually are rather than counting as cuts things that just go unspent.
Tim, last word on this.
Well, I was just going to say that really to echo your point that the size of these cuts is very small. And we were doing the math this morning and $350 million represents just a few hours of interest on the debt.
Yeah. Right?
And so the scale of these kinds of cuts compared to the costs that are incurred is still daunting.
Tim Hakes of Agilex and Larry Allen of Allen Federal, a terrific Federal News Countdown this week. Thanks very much to both of you for being on. It's a pleasure to have you on the program.
Thanks so much for having us.
Thanks, Francis.
You can